Hi, this is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. For a year now, shuttered businesses and quarantine restrictions have moved many of our interactions, economic or otherwise, online. That's meant a pandemic silver lining for Latin America and the Caribbean, while trends in digital financial inclusion were already taking hold before the coronavirus landed in the region, the pandemic accelerated the process. In Brazil alone, economic aid programs meant the country's unbanked population dropped by roughly 73%. In this episode, I spoke with Luz Gomez, the director covering Latin America and the Caribbean, and Arturo Franco, head of research and insights, both at MasterCard's Center for Inclusive Growth. They explain how a shift toward digital transactions spells benefits for sectors ranging from Colombian coffee growers to Mexican tiendita owners, as well as how to build on the momentum of growing financial inclusion to help Latin Americans be better prepared for a future crisis. As a disclaimer, MasterCard is a member company of the Council of the Americas. However, this episode is not sponsored.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en foco.
América Latina en foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you very much to both of you for being with me today on Latin America in Focus. It's a pleasure to host both of you. I want to start off with getting some context on Latin America and the issue of financial inclusion. So Latin America has actually a huge issue with its citizens being unbanked and challenges for financial inclusion. Can you place this problem into a global context for me? And Arturo, I'm going to start with you.
Yes, very happy to do that. I think we need to start with the question, why do we want or need financial inclusion in the first place? And what we have seen over the last decades is that financial inclusion can not just help boost economic growth, it can also reduce poverty and inequality, it can increase savings, it can improve the productivity of business, and ultimately ensure people against economic shocks like the ones we are going through right now. In the global context, in the decade between the last big crisis, the global financial crisis and the pandemic, the world actually moved quite rapidly into including more people into the financial system. We saw 1.2 billion adults gaining access in those years. But unfortunately, Latin America did not move as fast as other regions in the world. Up to January 2020, 55% of Latin American adults had an account in a financial institution, meaning that 45% of the adults in the region, around 200 million people, were excluded. This is particularly important for our region, not just because of the inequality, poverty rates, and economic growth issues that some of the countries have, but also because of this big issue called informality. Financial inclusion can be a great mechanism to bring both businesses and people into the formal economy as well. So that's why we have been focusing on financial inclusion for Latin America.
I want to just ask one follow-up question on that, Arturo. How does Latin America compare to the rest of the world in terms of financial inclusion?
Yeah, so Latin America lags behind. We have regions in the world, if you think about Europe, where the rates of people with access to universal, like basic financial services is higher than 70%, some countries even getting to 80 or 90%, where in Latin America, you have countries like Mexico, which have 65% of adults in Mexico still don't have access to, you know, any type of bank account, according to the last financial index from the World Bank. So you can see the massive gap that we need to bridge.
Thank you. Now, of course, some of what we're talking about, and you went back to the Great Recession, much has changed now that we are entering this period of the pandemic and a year into the pandemic. Luz, I'd like to hear from you. From some of the research that you've done, it sounds as though there is a bit of a silver lining to the pandemic in terms of financial inclusion in Latin America. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've seen in the past year?
Right. Thanks. First of all, building off of what Arturo said, you know, the unbanked population in Latin America varies pretty sharply from market to market. You know, Arturo talked about, 55% of adults in Latin America, you know, have an account at a financial institution, which means there's still over 200 million unbanked adults in the region. And so, you know, you have places like Brazil that are banked at 70%. Then, you know, Arturo talked about Mexico, which reports about a 37% banked rate. But if you dig down a little bit deeper, the picture becomes a bit more complex. So like just looking at Mexico, about twice as many of that figure I gave of a third of adults having access to a bank account, you know, people actually have some type of credit product offered by retailers, by non-bank entities. So I say all that in that financial inclusion isn't just one single metric. It's actually pretty multidimensional and could be enabled by a lot of different types of non-bank entities. But to your question on the silver lining, I say all that because there were these existing trends around digital financial services that were already happening across Latin America that I think have really been accelerated through the pandemic. You had some neobanks, you had fintechs playing a role, for example, in government social disbursement programs that got off the ground a couple of months into the pandemic in places like Colombia, for example. In Brazil, there was a huge program through the government state-owned bank Caixa that launched a pretty massive social aid program called the Corona Voucher Program that really encouraged the acceleration of digital financial services among the very vulnerable. You mentioned a report that we released around just three of those COVID-19 relief programs in the fall in Brazil, in Colombia, in Argentina, and it was pretty astounding, you know, just looking at those three programs, they brought in collectively 40 million people into the banking world in just those three countries, those three programs. And if you look even at just Brazil, you know, Brazil was able to reduce its unbanked population by a pretty amazing 73%. Colombia and Argentina also made some sort of admirable reductions, but you know, that Brazilian number really stood out. So I think that speaks to the potential and the acceleration that we're seeing in the region.
So Luz, to stay with you for a moment, I wanted to ask, are there certain types of transactions that you're seeing an increase of and other types of transactions you're seeing a decrease of in the world of financial inclusion? You mentioned this a little bit in talking about these three countries. Can you expand on that a little bit more and tell us a little bit more about those shifts and trends you're seeing?
Sure. You know, you're right. I think the devil is a bit in the details. You know, I think the question for me really is, you know, will people continue to use those accounts and not just cash out or let those accounts lie dormant? I think the key is that the financial services community continues to capitalize on the moment and make sure that these products are responding to everyday needs of the underserved. So just to give you kind of an example from work that we've been doing in Colombia, for example, working in the rural coffee sector, helping to digitize payments to farmers. And what we saw over the course of the latter half of the year during the pandemic was that these coffee farmers and their workers were actually using these new digital wallet accounts to receive their social disbursements from, you know, these emergency aid from the government, to send P2P payments to their family members across the country, which they had done in different ways prior to the pandemic. You see people topping up their mobile phones or paying bills, you know, things that they used to queue up for, again, pre-pandemic. which again, all these things, you know, in a pandemic environment strengthens usage, it motivates small and big changes in behavior. So I think the takeaway for me is that the financial service provider community really needs to pay close attention at what those behaviors are. And then products also need to be really valuable to low-income consumers' daily lives. And I think, you know, that's going to be the key if you're going to really continue to progress along this bump that happened during the pandemic.
So how do you do that, Liz? As you mentioned, you got to kind of maintain it, keep it going, and not fall back to where things were before the pandemic. What are some of the pitfalls that need to be avoided going ahead?
Well, I guess I'd make two points here. The first, again, is to this point of let's not miss this opportunity, right? What was interesting about the, you know, another insight from the study that you mentioned that we released in the fall was that there was this renewed inclination to save. So I think building in resilience for the inevitable next crisis needs to be kind of key within that. So, you know, that might look like incentivizing a short-term savings cushion. It might be innovating around providing access to affordable credit, insurance access for the underserved. And so I think, you know, all those things will help to build in more financial security. But I think it's also about building a robust ecosystem that's more attuned to serving the underserved. So it's not going to just be the fintechs and the neobanks that are going to be the saviors of the world, but it's going to be partnerships with traditional banking institutions or governments. Those are the institutions that right now have scale, right? It's engagement with microfinance institutions and co-ops that have a lot to say about serving the underserved because they've been doing it for decades. So I think it's complex, it's multi-sectoral, it's those kinds of sort of cross collaborations that need to happen if we want to really continue to move the needle on financial inclusion.
Great. And is there an example where you're seeing some of that? You're talking about working across a lot of different types of institutions. Is there an example that you're seeing in the region where those steps are being taken already now?
Yeah. And I think, you know, it speaks to some of the data that I laid out, right? In Mexico, there's people being served, maybe not through a traditional channel like a bank, but through retailers, retail institutions that have already started collaborating. There are financial services that are being offered via huge digital platforms. Like if you think about the Mercado Libres of the world, which is quote unquote the Amazon of Latin America, they're offering an array of digital services as well that are looking to serve both consumers as well as small merchants that are looking to gain access to capital, gain access to markets. So I think, you know, there's already kind of meeting of the minds, if you will, of institutions that are trying to collaborate to be able to better serve different segments of the population.
Great. And either of you can speak to this, but I'm wondering what role are governments playing? Are governments seeing this opportunity? And we talked a little bit about how, given the release of aid that has spurred from governments, that has spurred some activity towards getting people banked, are there any initiatives that governments are taking to push this forward? Other examples that you could give?
So if you think about COVID as a big accelerant, it's something that brought both a higher rate of transformation in having to make the economy digitize quicker, which I think in the context of financial inclusion is a positive because it basically had the effect of doing what we could have achieved in 10 years and compressing that into 1 year. On the other hand, it also made those same segments of the population that are most in need of affordable, reliable financial services, including women or micro merchants who traditionally are left out of the financial system, even more vulnerable, right? So you have an increased need in the population, and you are seeing on the negative side and on the positive side, you're seeing an acceleration of digital infrastructure and digital tools. I think in that context, many governments in Latin America have been able to use these new tools to reach households, to reach informal workers that we mentioned. I'm thinking of Peru, for example, with a billetera móvil that fully integrated the country's mobile operators, where they all came together with the banks as an example. And to the point, I think that Luz was making on these big platforms like Mercado Libre, what you see in the research, the Bank of International Settlements wrote a report, is that 1/3 of the people who got credits from Mercado Libre would not be served by traditional banks. So you're seeing also a real expansion of those very important tools, savings, credit, etc., getting to the people who need it the most.
Great, thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit more about something that Luz mentioned earlier, and that is that things are not the same in all countries. I know, for example, that Luz has done research around Mexico and tienditas, so small businesses or small shops where a lot of business is in cash. Are you seeing changes as a result of the pandemic or changes overall? I'm using the example of Mexico and its tienditas. I'm sure that this sort of cash business is not unique just to Mexico, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you're seeing in that case and other examples of distinct cases in other countries of how these transformations are happening.
I think, you know, again, there's a lot of similarities from country to country with respect to different segments that might still be left out, but it's quite pronounced for a country as large as Mexico. And you just mentioned the studies that we're doing in Guadalajara with small merchants. And the study really involves small merchants' aversion to accepting digital payments. And we've been working for the past couple of years with Stanford Business School to study sort of the dynamics of that aversion and try to get a sense of, you know, what it would it take to get these smaller merchants to accept payment technology and kind of get rid of the cash dynamic that really dominates in Mexico. And the stakes are high, right? If you look at Mexico, there's an estimated 2.1 million traditional tienditas or convenience stores that account for most sales among micro and small businesses. And 83% of those don't accept any other form of payment than cash. And so what the study was finding was that it wasn't for a sense of lack of information. So it wasn't an information problem. And it wasn't because, you know, there wasn't an affordable solution to be able to accept payments. And it wasn't that people, you know, had low digital literacy. You know, we found that people were actually, you know, high users of smartphones, especially in the urban, para-urban areas. Merchants were also using tech for their business in some shape or form. And so what we found was that there was that reluctance because they're being pretty strategic about how they were thinking about it. There was these perceptions of low demand for digital payments, even in places where there was actually quite a good penetration of debit card users. And there was this sort of cost benefit calculation that these businesses had. So I think what's clear is that if you're going to be successful in sort of tackling this type of population, small merchant population, and really trying to expand financial inclusion and increasing usage and really driving change in that area, we need to understand what are the needs and the barriers of those consumers. And so I think, you know, those are the types of insights I think that are helpful in designing and building products that are useful to people's lives.
And to talk a little bit more about some of the differences between countries, we know that in Latin America, especially in the past year, the response has really varied from country to country to the pandemic overall. Whether we're talking about lockdowns, in some countries there just have not been lockdowns, in others there have been very strict lockdowns and curfews, to what we see governments doing in terms of their disbursement of aid. Are you seeing that reflected in the research and work you're doing in terms of financial inclusion or accessing some of these digital tools? Because as we know, there are some countries where people have even been forbidden to go to the store, right? So I'm curious if you've seen a difference among countries as a result of these different government responses to what's happening on the ground.
We have a partnership, the Center for Inclusive Growth has a partnership with the Fletcher School at Tufts University with an initiative called Digital Planet. And the researchers there have been analyzing how different countries responded differently to COVID, as you said, lockdowns, no lockdowns, more or less ability to deliver services and goods based on their digital infrastructure. And what they found is that obviously there were countries that had a much higher digital preparedness, and that allowed in this very particular type of crisis for the countries to navigate the last year in a more positive way than those that didn't have the adequate digital preparedness. I think at the bottom of this question is also a question about trust in government, trust in institutions, trust in the banking sector. I think trust is a big component of what we want to understand in Latin America with the research we're going to be doing around financial inclusion, because perception and trust are very related.
Luz, would you like to add to that?
I guess the only thing I would say is that, you know, 1 year into the pandemic, you know, the total lockdowns have been untenable. You know, I think most economies and small businesses have had to open just to survive. And, you know, you see real differences in terms of governments responding. I know, for example, the state-owned bank, Banco do Povo in Brazil, just put out access to credit for small micro entrepreneurs, a pretty large program, but it hasn't been uniform across the region in terms of government's ability to respond with these sort of stimulus programs. And so I think you see a lot of unevenness across the region in terms of how businesses are able to juggle and adapt to this new digital reality, right? You know, on the one hand, I think women in particular women-owned businesses have been particularly hard hit because they're juggling also sort of work at home, as well as trying to see how they manage through this new economy.
Thank you. And Arturo, you mentioned future research that you'll be doing around financial inclusion. As I understand it, you will soon be launching a new project with academic institutions in Latin America. Can you tell listeners a little bit about what's ahead with that?
Yes, very happy to. So as Luz was saying, one fundamental opportunity that we have is to use the current environment to better understand those barriers that she was talking about for both businesses and people to get financially integrated and to learn about what technologies, what policies, what partnerships can help shape the future of the financial ecosystem to make it more inclusive. And so we've launched a research center called the Financial Access and Inclusion Research Center at Tecnológico de Monterrey in Mexico, which will be joining forces with universities in Colombia and Chile to try to understand some of the questions that we have been talking about here, about awareness and education and financial literacy, about good practices for savings and for fostering savings and credit, about how to transform the financial system to get everyone included and to make it easier for people to have financial health and security in their lives.
Thank you. And I want to wrap up with one last question that both of you can answer. I'm going to let Luz start. Given that we're talking about the future and we're now entering, it's hard to believe we've been with a year of this pandemic. We're entering a new phase with vaccinations. We know that things are going slower in Latin America. What are things that you're keeping an eye out for in particular and specifically in this new year and in an evolving situation?
You know, I think what I'm keeping an eye on is making sure that people like women are really well served during the pandemic. I think, you know, if you even look at some of the data around who is still unbanked, you know, women are overrepresented in that. And so I've been thinking a lot about how to continue to support women and women-led businesses in that journey through recovery, whether that's, you know, helping them shift their markets because the dynamics of their client bases change, whether that's in helping them to access credit through different programs that we're launching, or even just adjusting to this new digital environment and making sure that digital tools really work for them. So I think, you know, maybe it's because it's International Women's Month, but I think, you know, making sure that we stay focused on those that are overrepresented in, amongst the unbanked.
Thank you. Arturo, is there anything you'd like to add to close?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we have been noticing starting in 2020, but going into 2021 is, you know, more openness for people to discuss deeper solutions to economic exclusion. The Center for Inclusive Growth has been around for 7 years. We've been talking about inequality, the digital divide, you know, financial exclusion for many years. But when things are growing and when the economy seems to be fine, there's very little space. People don't really want to change too much of when things look like they're working out. But I think this is a moment where people are more open to structural change. And so we're trying to shape that conversation to create a more inclusive economy.
Wonderful. Thank you very much to both of you for joining me today. It was a pleasure to hear more about the research and work that you're both doing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karen Zissis. This episode was produced by Katie Hopkins. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For upcoming concerts online, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word. Write us a review, give us 5 stars, share, and subscribe at Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.